My objective is to open the eyes of the masses and start people to realize that, hey, nitric oxide is important. And if you have a poorly managed disease with standard pharmacotherapy, then start taking into consideration some of these common sense approaches and restore nitric oxide and be able to wean off drugs, allow the body to heal itself. And that's how humans are designed to react.
Well, hello, everyone. Dr. David Perlmutter here. Welcome again to the program, The Empowering Neurologist. There's a lot of talk these days about something called nitric oxide. It's a very, very fundamental chemical in the human body. It is actually a gas, but it plays incredible roles in metabolic function, including things like blood pressure regulation, how insulin works. It even acts as a neurotransmitter. We're going to learn a lot more about nitric oxide today on the program, and we really should, because this is really state-of-the-art science that has huge implications as it relates to human health. Our guest is Dr. Nathan Bryan, who's looked upon really, I think, as being center stage as it relates currently to nitric oxide research and development. Let me tell you a little bit more about Dr. Bryan. Dr. Nathan Bryan earned his undergraduate Bachelor of Science degree in biochemistry from the University of Texas at Austin, and then went on to get his doctoral degree from Louisiana State University School of Medicine, where he was the recipient of the Dean's Award for Excellence in Research. He then did his postdoc training at Boston University School of Medicine, and then was recruited to join the faculty at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston by Fareed Mirad, who ultimately went on to win the 1998 Nobel Prize as it relates to nitric oxide. Dr. Bryan has been involved in nitric oxide research for the past 20 years and has made a variety of really seminal discoveries in this field. These discoveries have resulted in dozens of issued U.S. patents, as well as international patents, and product technology resulting from his discoveries and inventions has improved patient care around the world. So we are just delighted as can be to welcome Dr. Bryan to the program. Hello, Dr. Bryan. Welcome to our program.
Dr. Perlmutter, thank you very much for having me. It's a great honor and pleasure to be with you.
I want to start off by saying that you and I spoke several years ago, but I think we kindled our friendship, or maybe rekindled our friendship, at the PLMI meeting in Chicago, and I was very, very overwhelmed by your presentation, which... You know, because I've been thinking about nitric oxide for an awful long time, obviously in relationship to uric acid and even obviously prior to that. And then the way that you just opened up the whole universe to the implications of this gas, this chemical molecule, was really breathtaking. So I want to jump right in. I think that our viewers are probably aware of nitric oxide, but certainly not the nuances that are coming to light day in and day out. So why don't we start just by talking to those who don't know, what is nitric oxide, and then we'll develop it from there.
Sure. Well, thanks for the kind words. And we've been working with this for almost 25 years now. But yeah, nitric oxide is a signaling molecule. And it's really a unique molecule produced in the body of humans, in fact, all mammals. But it's a gas, which makes it unique. And so once it's produced, it's gone in less than a second. So it's produced, it activates some second messengers, and then starts this whole signaling cascade. So it's how cells in the body communicate. Its most common recognized function is in vasodilation. So when nitric oxide is produced in the lining of the blood vessels, it causes the smooth muscles to relax and dilate. So you basically get vasodilation, normalization of blood pressure, regulation of blood flow to every organ, tissue, and cell in the body. But it's a neurotransmitter in the central nervous system. So as you're well aware, it's extremely important as a signal in neurocognition, deficiencies of which cause neurodegenerative disorders. And it's how our immune system fights off invading pathogens from, you know, bacteria to viruses to, you know, any type of parasite. So it's really, you know, the simplicity of this molecule, but yet the number of important roles it plays in human physiology is really fascinating. And now there are 195,000 papers published in the scientific literature on nitric oxide. So we continue to learn more each day.
The reason I'm smiling is because my mind is going 1,000 miles an hour right now. I mean, I don't know where to take this conversation. I really don't, because you know, do we go to cardiovascular health? Do we go to sexuality? Do we go to neurotransmitter production? Do we go to MTHFR polymorphism? It's all over the place. And again, for our viewers, this is really incredibly important information. I think I would say it's Nobel Prize worthy information, but in fact, the Nobel Prize has already been awarded due to the research in identifying the roles of nitric oxide. But interestingly, I heard you interviewed talking about that at the time of the Nobel Prize, that there really weren't any ways to measure nitric oxide, really quantify what in the heck's going on in the body. How far have we come in terms of recognizing how important this molecule is? Where are we today, 2023, in being able to say, well, we can measure some things and let you know where you are as it relates to nitric oxide?
Sure. Well, there's still kind of a bridge or gap between research and clinical medicine. So in the research lab, you know, we have nitric oxide gas phase analyzers. We can measure nitric oxide gas. We can measure oxidative metabolites of nitric oxide. But clinically, there's really still no way to measure nitric oxide. So it's, you know, it's unlike, say, vitamin D or cholesterol, which are stable in blood, so you can pull blood and measure these molecules in blood. Nitric oxide is a gas, and it's fleeting, so it's gone in less than a second. So it's really impossible to measure nitric oxide in blood or in peripheral blood in terms of a diagnostic or prognostic indicator. However, there are indirect measures. And so in 2010, I developed really the first point of care non-invasive salivary diagnostic for nitric oxide. So what we're measuring is salivary nitrite, and there's a number of different pathways that lead to accumulation of salivary nitrite. It's the oxidation of endogenously produced nitric oxide, or it's the reduction of inorganic nitrate that comes from green leafy vegetables by oral nitrate-reducing bacteria. So it gives us what we call kind of a total body proxy for nitric oxide production. But I tell people it's a good tool to have in your toolbox, but it's really not the only thing you should be using. So really what we rely on in clinical medicine are symptoms. And there's known symptoms of nitric oxide deficiency. The first one is an increase in blood pressure. And you know, 2 out of 3 Americans have an unsafe elevation in blood pressure. And really the first sign and symptom of nitric oxide deficiency is erectile dysfunction. And that's in both men and women, and vascular dementia, insulin signaling. So when you lose the ability to regulate blood flow or to increase blood flow, improve perfusion to select organs upon need, then that's a sign of nitric oxide deficiency. And collectively, that's referred to as endothelial dysfunction.
So let me just break this down. You've said quite a bit just now. In fact, it could be an entire podcast. Yes. That this chemical is difficult to measure because its life is so darn short, but nonetheless, it's directly involved in how the endothelium, the lining of the blood, the cells lining the blood vessels, are able to do their job. It's involved in the relaxation of blood vessels, allowing blood supply to the various organs. And you did mention it's also involved in what is called insulin signaling. So that deficiencies of availability or functionality of this chemical, nitric oxide, relate to things like insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. Now, for me, where the story gets really incredible, and you know, I recently did a podcast with a Dr. Mark Berhenna, who's a dentist. We were talking about oral health. We were talking about the bacteria in the mouth. And the story is that we can't change food-related nitrate into available nitrite that is necessary for the formation of nitric oxide, this incredibly valuable chemical that we've been discussing. We depend on bacteria, mostly living in the mouth, but throughout the gastrointestinal system. But there's a lot of studies being done in the mouth that look at how these bacteria convert our food-related nitrate into nitrite that then becomes stored and available for nitric oxide production. So in a very real sense then, what you've said is that things like blood pressure and risk for diabetes are dependent upon the health and functionality of the bacteria in the mouth through the mechanism of their role in the creation of this very important chemical called nitric oxide. As such, if you damage those bacteria, there could be hell to pay. How do we damage those mouth-related bacteria? I'm really setting you up, am I not?
Yeah, that's great.
I thought it through.
I need you to take me with me when my lecture, so you can really set the stage, because it's so it's so complicated. And one of the things I've always been a big fan of yours is you take really complex concepts and make them really simple and easy for patients and consumers to understand. So yeah,
I'm actually very much a simpleton, and so that's the only way I can see the world through it down.
We were one of the first people to demonstrate the role of oral bacteria in the regulation of systemic blood pressure. And so now we're finding, and we've published, I don't know, 3 or 4 papers on this, where if you disrupt the oral microbiome, the oral flora, it leads to a downregulation or decreased production of nitric oxide, and we see an increase in blood pressure. And then all the other symptoms that follow nitric oxide deficiency are ensued. So how do you do that? Well, if you use mouthwash, any type of antiseptic mouthwash, 2 out of 3 Americans wake up every morning and use antiseptic mouthwash, killing the bacteria, leading to an increase in blood pressure. And also, you lose the protective benefits of exercise if you use mouthwash. So that's number one. And I tell people, if you use mouthwash, you have to stop. I mean, it's a risk-benefit analysis. And we're finding, as science progresses, that the risk of mouthwash and killing the nitric oxide producing bacteria far outweigh the benefits of killing any gingival caries causing plaque. The other is fluoride. You know, fluoride's a neurotoxin, it's an antiseptic, and it destroys your thyroid function. So we have to get rid of fluoride-based toothpaste. We have to, filter the fluoride out of municipal water systems. And then the other, are antibiotics. 200 million prescriptions written for antibiotics every year. And there's collateral damage. You want to kill the infectious pathogenic bacteria, but there's always collateral damage from overuse of antibiotics. And so these are the things.
Let me break this down.
And it's really the mechanism of the oral systemic link. And as you know, probably in discussing with this dentist, that people with poor oral hygiene have a higher incidence of heart attack, stroke, cardiovascular disease. And this is the link.
And Alzheimer's.
And Alzheimer's.
Which is, Alzheimer's, as we now describe it, is really fundamentally metabolic. It's an insulin, people have called it type 3 diabetes. It's an insulin resistance basically in the brain. Insulin requires nitric oxide. We can't have adequate amounts of nitric oxide if we don't have good oral health. And good oral health means nurturing the oral bacteria to a significant degree, not killing 99% of germs, which television commercials tell us that's what we should be doing. We should be sterilizing the mouth. So you're making this connection between the use of mouthwash, 200 million Americans do this every day, and risk for diabetes and risk for high blood pressure simply by using mouthwash. But that's what we were told we needed to do.
That's right. Well, it's probably not surprising to you, but a lot of the things, the information we get from the media or the so-called experts aren't always the truth, or at least the full truth. So we have to rely on, science and, real science and not only just the basic science, but the translation of that basic science into clinical medicine. And that's where the true story is revealed. But yeah, to me, yeah, it's
and I tell you, I know that viewers are watching this right now and nodding their heads. Are you telling me that my mouthwash could put me at risk for high blood pressure? And it is what we are saying. And it's not just an interesting association, but what you've done, Dr. Brian, is you've demonstrated the actual mechanism, i.e. connecting the scientific dots that make it very understandable as to how this is occurring.
Yeah, no doubt. It's been really amazing. And it's, it explains a lot. It explains resistant hypertension. And obviously as a physician, you know this, but if you have high blood pressure and you go to your primary care physician or cardiologist and he puts you on a blood pressure medicine, such as an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, or calcium channel antagonist, 50% of those medicated patients don't respond with better blood pressure. And why is that? Because this hypertension may be a symptom of oral dysbiosis. And so these types of drugs and their mechanism of action aren't designed to restore the oral flora. They're hitting other pathways that may not be the cause of the underlying hypertension. So we have to, what I tell people is, look, just stop using the mouthwash, allow the diversity of the oral microbiome to repopulate. And what we published on is the higher the diversity, the better the blood pressure management, and the more of these nitrate reducing bacteria are present.
Wow. I would say who knew or who would know, but the reality is, We should have known recognizing this meta organism that we are, that there would be a symbiosis between the good guys in our mouths. We now accept it in the gut, that's for sure, and on the skin, but in the mouth as well. And
that's right.
There is one other area that seems to be threatening, and that is the use of these proton pump inhibiting drugs, acid blocking drugs, if you will. And how? What's the mechanism there?
Well, it's really part of the mechanism of nitric oxide production. So the human body makes nitric oxide through two independent and completely separate pathways. One, we talked about through the enzyme nitric oxide synthase that's found in the endothelial cells, the cells that line the blood vessels. And the other is through this bacterial reduction of nitrate to nitrite. And then when we swallow our saliva, as long as there's stomach acid, you know, it becomes protonated and we generate nitric oxide gas. Interestingly, proton pump inhibitors inhibit nitric oxide from both pathways. So these are extremely dangerous drugs. And, you know, they were never approved for long-term use by the FDA. These drugs were only approved for acute use in gastroesophageal reflux disease. And now the data are showing us that people who have been on PPIs for 3 to 5 years, this was worked by John Cook, a colleague of mine at Houston Methodist, showed that they have a 30 to 40% higher incidence of heart attack and stroke. So what's happening is these drugs are inhibiting an enzyme called DDAH, which lead to an increase in a metabolite called asymmetric dimethyl L-arginine, or ADMA. And now these are known risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So not only is it inhibiting the nitric oxide being produced in the lining of the blood vessel, but if we suppress stomach acid production, we lose the nitric oxide that's being produced by swallowing our own saliva from this conversion of nitrate to nitrite. So these are extremely dangerous drugs, and the consequences are very clear now.
I wrote a blog several, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, probably at least, actually, even longer than that. And I said, how Larry the Cable Guy may be giving you dementia.
That's right.
And it was because even back then, we began to see the literature of about people who are chronically taking these acid-blocking drugs having a dramatic increased risk for dementia and, as you mentioned, stroke as well. You know, the mechanisms that we fell back on were the changes in the pH in the gut, how that would change the gut bacteria and might favor pro-inflammatory array of organisms. But now through the understanding of their role in terms of nitric oxide production, it really does seem to make sense. And, you know, it seems to be it seems to be so valuable to make these considerations. And yet you mentioned it earlier, mainstream pharmacology doesn't really want to go there, doesn't really want to embrace the notion of above all, do no harm. And we write these blogs, we get criticized for it. But, you know, the point is, this is good peer-reviewed science that is published, and people certainly need to be made aware of it. But it's why we do what we do.
Absolutely.
So the nitric oxide made in our bodies from nitrite, which is converted from nitrate due to an enzyme that we as humans and all mammals lack, but the bacteria in our mouths and elsewhere in our digestive system are able to help us with, so we have to be kind to them. These nitrates come from the diet. So what are good dietary sources then of the nitrates that we should be thinking about?
Well, you know, it's kind of on a, generally speaking, it's dark green leafy vegetables. And typically the darker the green vegetable, the higher the nitrate content. And this is, you know, most foods grown in the soil are dependent upon the availability of nitrogen. You have to assimilate nitrogen in the form of nitrate to really assimilate other nutrients. You know, there's a misconception. You know, people, you mentioned nitrate or nitrite, the first thing people go to is, oh, hot dogs and bacon and cured meats.
And hot dog.
That's a misconception. You know, again, we were not told the entire truth over the past 50 or 60 years, and the innovations and the progress we've made in science hasn't really been communicated effectively. But 85% of the nitrate we get comes from green leafy vegetables. Only 5% comes from cured and processed meats, and the other 10% comes from swallowing your own saliva. So it's really the mechanism of action for a plant-based diet, a vegetarian diet, the cardioprotective benefits of a Japanese diet, the dietary approaches to stop hypertension, which we published on in 2009. That's the mechanism of how these diets are affording not just the cardioprotective effects of these dietary patterns and certain food choices, but also in many cases, the anti-cancer effects of many of these dietary patterns.
Well, you mentioned, just to be clear, the DASH diet. One other consideration, there are many, but is the production of nitric oxide requires availability of adequate oxygen. So how might it be affected, nitric oxide production, for example, in somebody that has some sort of illness that creates lower oxygen hypoxia, like sleep apnea, for example? How does that fall into this discussion?
Well, the part of this 5-electron oxidation of arginine to make nitric oxide is dependent upon oxygen. And so in tissue beds where there's insufficient oxygen, then you can't make nitric oxide. And it's really this perpetual cycle, because without nitric oxide, you can't deliver oxygen. Without oxygen, you can't make nitric oxide. So you have to correct it. And it's kind of like the chicken or the egg, right? You have to get oxygen to make nitric oxide, but you have to have nitric oxide to deliver oxygen to every cell in the body. And, you know, we experienced that over the past 3 years with COVID, and it really revealed the importance of nitric oxide and oxygen saturation and oxygen delivery. Because, you know, everybody knows that if you get COVID, you drop your blood oxygen saturation. They give you 100% oxygen, still didn't improve it. They put you in a mechanical vent, it didn't improve it. And a lot of times these people die. Well, what the science revealed to us is that nitric oxide is required for oxygen uptake and delivery. So in these patients who had increased risk and death of COVID, these were the patients who couldn't make nitric oxide. The hypertensives, the patients with previous heart attacks, diabetes, pulmonary disorders. And so when we, in our COVID drug study, we could just give our nitric oxide drug and improve blood oxygen saturation from 76 to 98 within 8 minutes, even just breathing room air or 21% oxygen. So you have to fix the underlying disorder and the mechanism of all of these diseases. And as you know, the common denominator in every major chronic disease, whether it's Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, is insufficient blood flow or ischemia and hypoxia to that particular vascular bed.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think the fix for what you're talking about ends up getting back to what is the universal fix or the fixes. It's eating right, getting enough sleep, breathing right, which I think not a lot of people talk about. You know, basically taking care of yourself. I think in terms of the dietary recommendations, I think you've been very clear that it's just about getting adequate amounts of nitrate through dark green leafy vegetables. And it's not necessarily a call for vegetarianism. I mean, there's no threat to this pathway by consuming animal products, is there?
No, in fact, you know, I'm not a big fan of these extreme diets, whether it's straight carnivore or straight vegan and vegetarian. I think we need a diverse food supply to get the many essential vitamins and minerals we need. But no, there's no disruption in the nitric oxide production from eating animal proteins versus plant proteins. But what's clear is that you have to have a sufficient supply of nitrate in order to keep both of these pathways functional so that you're optimizing both production pathways.
Probably no segue here, but I guess under the main umbrella of nitric oxide consideration. And let me define this a little bit and people will then get the connection. So I've mentioned on this program many times that in my genetic profile, I have what's called a polymorphism or a variation, if you will, in something called MTHFR. And that's probably maybe 20 to 30% of people have a variation as you look at your 23andMe or whatever genome profile you have in something called methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, an enzyme involved in the methylation pathway, more specifically how our bodies are able to deal with something called homocysteine.
Right.
But you've been able to relate this MTHFR polymorphism, again, we're talking about perhaps 20 to 30% of people, to deficiencies in the creation of a particular chemical, tetrahydrobiopterin, and that may compromise the formation of nitric oxide, therefore giving us a better understanding as to the vascular and cognitive and even mood issues related to carrying this MTHFR polymorphism. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure. So in biochemistry, you know, these metabolites feed, some of the metabolite from one reaction feeds into another. So the MTHFR, I mean, most, as you said, recognize it as a methylating enzyme and involved in kind of a methylation cycle and defects of such. But part of what this enzyme does is it reduces biopterin to tetrahydrobiopterin. So it's redox cycling. And if you can't reduce biopterin to tetrahydrobiopterin, then the availability of BH4 or tetrahydrobiopterin is the rate limiting step in nitric oxide production. So if you have an MTHFR SNP, then it leads to an inefficient reduction to BH4. And then that's the rate limiting step, and it uncouples the NOS enzyme, and you're no longer able to produce nitric oxide. So this really is a risk factor. And I think, as you said, it really explains a lot of these previously unexplained symptoms that were typically unrelated to a methylation issue.
Well, you know, and I learned about BH4 in the context of my nitric oxide production, but also recognize that it's fundamental in the production of a variety of neurochemicals, norepinephrine, dopamine, and even serotonin. And the fix for me and I guess others who would be to add higher levels of folinic acids, what I'm using, and then we are facilitating the methylation pathway, and hopefully it's a bit of biochemistry, that's for sure. But you know, I have to admit that this kind of stuff isn't going to enter into your typical interaction, 15-minute interaction with your general physician. I mean, it's a little bit intense, but you know, it's good to know what your genetic predispositions are, right?
Absolutely.
So getting back to how do we correct this with food, you're talking about green leafy vegetables. There's a real trend these days to, maybe in the interest of convenience or time, to spin this your vegetables down in a blender of sorts and suck it down and be on your way. And to me, if we're depending upon having the mouth be able to expose itself to levels of nitrate in order for these reactions to happen, it would seem to me that that's not a good plan, that chewing your vegetables might be a better idea than being on your way.
Well, you know, I think it's part of this is recycled. So it's taken up in the gut and then concentrated back in our salivary glands. But you make a very good point. One of the first steps in digestion is the mastication and having a certain resident time in the mouth for these bacteria to metabolize a lot of food nutrients. And the one we focus on is nitrate. So there has to be a resident time in the mouth for these bacteria to respire and reduce the nitrate to nitrite. So, you know, I think it's not only important to masticate and chew your food to allow that resident time, but also to break it up into smaller particles so you increase the surface area and it just leads to better digestion. So there's a number of reasons to do this, but it has to have a certain resident time for these bacteria to utilize it.
Now, our ability to make nitric oxide is age dependent. It declines as we get older, doesn't it?
Well, the function of the NOS enzyme, so half of the pathway to make nitric oxide. And so this has been well studied now for probably 30 years, looking at this age-dependent loss of endothelial function or the ability of the enzyme and the endothelial cells to produce nitric oxide. And that's just kind of on a population-based studies. But as you know, there are 20, 25-year-old kids who have a vascular age and a nitric oxide production of a 60 or 70-year-old. And to the contrary, you know, I'll be 50 this year, but I have a vascular age of a 36 or 37-year-old. So, you know, we know that we can shift this curve to the left and to the right, but kind of when you look at population-based studies, there seems to be about a 10 to 12% decline in our nitric oxide production per decade. So by the time we're 40 years old, you know, we only have about 50% of the nitric oxide we had through that enzyme when we were younger. But the dietary pathway doesn't seem to be affected by age, but it certainly is affected by the foods we eat, and it's certainly affected by the presence or absence of these essential bacteria in the mouth.
Mm-hmm. And there are ways of otherwise, aside from the foods we eat, what else can a person do to increase the availability of oral nitrate to boost nitric oxide production?
Well, number one, you have to get rid of mouthwash and stop the collateral damage from killing not only the bad guys, but, you know, killing a lot of the good guys. And so, you know, it's really very simple. It's a complex science, but you made a good point earlier. It's really just good diet, exercise, and lifestyle. And a lot of this is going to be money saving because, you know, if you stop using mouthwash, that's going to save you money. If you get rid of fluoride, you know, there's some fluoride-free toothpaste out there, and we're not asking you to do anything more. A lot of this is just eliminating certain practices. So we're going to simplify your life. So I tell people, you have to get rid of mouthwash, get rid of fluoride, throw in some more green leafy vegetables, and then just moderate physical exercise and exposure to sunlight. You know, there's certain wavelengths of light that stimulate or release nitric oxide when exposed to the skin. So these are just common sense, real world approaches to improve nitric oxide. It's not rocket science.
I have to say that every guest on the program that indicates what you just indicated about fluoride, every time we do that, there's always comments. Oh, fluoride's so important. My dentist says I have to have fluoride treatments. My children have to have fluoride treatments. And gosh, I'm in a position or the position that would indicate that that's bad advice, not what we should be doing for a number of reasons. We'll do, actually, we just did a podcast on that. Viagra works in a sense to improve endothelial function via the nitric oxide pathway to help with erectile dysfunction in men and women, for that matter. And one would think then if there is a way we could be looking at the large data sets to determine things like Alzheimer's risk, you would think Alzheimer's having a vascular component and a insulin component, that that might be affected by people who frequently use Viagra. So there is a study that demonstrated that. What does that reveal to us?
Well, it shows us that really it's if you can restore blood flow or maintain blood flow, then, you know, a lot of times you don't get this chronic dysfunction that leads to chronic disease. So Viagra, or what we call phosphodiesterase inhibitors, are dependent upon nitric oxide production. So these aren't nitric oxide generating drugs. They potentiate nitric oxide based signaling. So if you're able to produce a little bit of nitric oxide, and then it activates an enzyme called guanylyl cyclase, leads to an increase in cyclic GMP, and then these PDE5 inhibitors permit the breakdown of that second messenger. So you can actually, you know, sensitize the system, and that's why they work for improving erectile dysfunction. The problem is, you know, these drugs were approved, I believe, in 1998, so we're 25 years on the market, and, you know, they only work in about 40 to 50% of the men in which they're prescribed. So these non-responders, mechanistically, are non-responders because their body is not making any nitric oxide to activate the system for these drugs to work on. So we can now, if you restore nitric oxide, you can turn non-responders into responders, and then the end result is vasodilation. And vasodilation leads to increase in oxygen and nutrient delivery to every organ, tissue, and cell in the body. So to get back to your question, the results of this study that you mentioned, people who have been on, you know, PDE5 inhibitors for a number of years now have lower incidence of Alzheimer's, vascular dementia, a lot of these neurocognitive disorders. So why is that? Well, it's because they're not experiencing this focal ischemia or hypoxia at a certain regions of the brain. And you get the good stuff in, you take the bad stuff out, you don't get buildup of amyloid or tau tangles, and you get normal cellular function. All of it's dependent upon sufficient regulation of blood flow.
So erectile dysfunction in men in their 50s and 60s is really a surrogate marker for a systemic issue related to nitric oxide, and it's a very, very big deal. And I'm sure there's psychogenic issues that could explain erectile dysfunction as well. But in general, if it's a vascular issue, I mean, we know it's correlated with cardiovascular risk, that's for sure, but this becomes the unifying mechanism.
Okay. So the results of the study you mentioned can be explained by increase in blood flow and preventing this focal ischemia and hypoxia to certain regions of the brain. So the take-home message for this is if you can maintain normal blood flow and circulation to every organ, including the brain, then the data tell us that you can prevent the onset and progression of many of these disorders, including Alzheimer's and vascular dementia.
Well, important that you mention that, both men and women. And so...
No, that's right. It is the canary in the coal mine because, again, we have to regulate blood flow upon demand, right? So when we're stimulated or... So there's both a neural connection through these non-adrenergic, non-cholinergic nerve endings in the erectile tissue, but also the blood vessels. You know, when we dilate the blood vessels of the sex organs, we get engorgement, it shuts off the outflow, and that's what's responsible for erections in both men and women.
So
for us, it's
all, go ahead.
Both men and women, yeah, whether it's a penile erection or a clitoral erection, you know, it's all about increasing blood supply, which is dependent upon nitric oxide.
That's right.
To get the increase in pressure and the engorgement. Wow. So without that, if you can't regulate blood flow to the sex organs, you also have that same vascular dysfunction in the coronary arteries, the heart, in the brain, in the kidney, in the liver. So this is really a systemic disease, but it first manifests itself in the sex organs.
Now, you are working on pharmaceutical interventions that target this pathway. And
that's right.
So we have great hope that we're soon going to be able to dramatically change the playing field as it relates to this whole paradigm. In a country where some 83 million people are either diabetic or pre-diabetic, now that we understand the relationship to nitric oxide and insulin functionality, this becomes a big deal. The relationship to hypertension, it becomes a huge deal. And in fact, I remember in your lecture, there was probably nothing off the table in terms of what you'd relate nitric oxide to. One of the areas that was so compelling in your talk was wound healing. And so you've developed some topical delivery systems for nitric oxide that are effective in wound healing.
Yeah, that's right. So, I've been in the nitric oxide field for, I guess, going on 25 years now. And most, at the time I entered in the late 90s, every major pharmaceutical company had a nitric oxide drug pipeline trying to develop nitric oxide drugs. Every single one of them failed. And I think they failed because they didn't understand the mechanism of production and how to create nitric oxide or recapitulate nitric oxide signaling that would basically mimic endogenous production. And, I'm proud to say that we cracked that code. I have several dozen issued patents. And so, as you mentioned, we've now licensed my patents from the University of Texas through our drug company where we're commercializing this. And the wound care, I think, is, for me, it's personal because my dad, who's a paraplegic, we've dealt with, decubitus pressure ulcers for most of my childhood and adult life. And so I've been treating wounds and ulcers since I was 10 years old. And what we found was about 15 years ago that nitric oxide would completely lead to an increase in blood flow and not only cause the hyperemia to the ischemic wound bed and get tissue granulation, but nitric oxide at the doses we're producing is antimicrobial. So it actually kills the infection that's common in most of these non-healing ulcers. So to me, it does everything you need to heal a very complex wound. Get blood supply to the wound, kill the infection, allow for granulation, tissue growth, and the body heals itself. And as you know, there's been no innovations in wound care for 50 years. We still treat wounds the same way we did in 1960, through negative pressure and through trying to kill the infection.
Well, I think hyperbaric oxygen has been effective. And now that I think about it, that might be enhancing nitric oxide availability.
Well, there was a study, I believe it was in the late 90s, early 2000s, showing that the mechanism of action of hyperbaric oxygen was through the production of nitric oxide, which then mobilized stem cells to go to the site of the wound and basically heal itself. So there are stimulants and activators of this pathway that are clinically proven. Hyperbaric oxygen is one. But what we do is we just add nitric oxide directly to the wound bed, and we've seen 3- and 4-year-old non-healing ulcers completely heal with just the nitric oxide topical drug. Wow. In a period of 3 to 4
Well, we do have an image here it looks like a woman with a lesion on her face. Maybe you can walk us through what we're looking at and what's on the right side.
Yeah, this was a patient of Dr. Greg Chernoff, who's a triple board certified plastic surgeon. And so he did a facelift on this patient, and she went back and started smoking. And sitting at her desk, she's smoking and applying pressure with her thumb and developed a full thickness ulcer within a period of days. And obviously, they were very concerned about scarring and kind of suturing this up. So in his infinite wisdom, he said, well, let me try a topical nitric oxide that we had sent him. And he applied that topically twice a day for 10 days and got complete closure with very little scar formation and really no suturing for the wound itself. And so that was really eye-opening, not only for him in these complex patients, and try to mediate, scar formation and preventing infections in these patients. And so that was really an eye-opening experience and really started our way on filing the investigative new drug applications for the FDA, because it was an amazing result.
Back in the day, I remember at the gym, arginine was popularized for a while. It was popular for as a you know, a way to increase your nitric oxide production. But I think you made it clear that that really is not what we want to be doing.
Now, you know, this became popular in 1998. This was the year the Nobel Prize was awarded for the discovery of nitric oxide. And then it was recognized that this enzyme actually converts arginine to nitric oxide, the nitric oxide synthase enzyme. So that's in young, healthy people with normal vascular function. And now the clinical data has shown us that if you have patients with endothelial dysfunction, what that means is the NOS enzyme is uncoupled, so it can no longer convert arginine to nitric oxide. And now if you give high-dose arginine to these patients, it leads to superoxide production, and it basically exacerbates the underlying condition. So two studies that I know have been published, one in post-infarct patients, you give high-dose L-arginine, higher mortality than placebo. They stopped the trial. This was published in 2006. Several years later, they tried the same experiment giving L-arginine to patients with peripheral artery disease. Again, another vascular dysfunction. And these patients on arginine actually got worse. Intermittent claudication increased, and patient outcomes got worse. So this told us, and really told the entire scientific and medical community, that arginine is not the solution for nitric oxide. In fact, it should be contraindicated in patients with endothelial dysfunction. So we have to recouple the enzyme, and then the body can actually utilize endogenous arginine. You know, arginine is a semi-essential amino acid, meaning we get part of it from the breakdown of proteins, but the other part comes from the urea cycle. So we're never deficient in arginine, so it doesn't make sense to supplement arginine. The body already makes enough to saturate that enzyme.
You made it clear that we need available oxygen to produce nitric oxide, and the time we really need nitric oxide to make sure we have blood supply to our muscles is when we're exercising. But we can get to a point where we begin to engage anaerobic or metabolism that's not using oxygen, producing lactate. And one would think that might threaten then nitric oxide production.
Well, no, you're exactly right. So once you reach that anaerobic threshold and oxygen becomes limiting, then you shut down nitric oxide production and you run out of fuel. And then you lead to anaerobic metabolism, lactic acid production, soreness, and poor recovery. What we're finding is that in well-trained individuals, when you begin to exercise before you reach that anaerobic threshold, they're producing a lot of nitric oxide, and this builds up as nitrate and nitrite. And now when you reach that anaerobic threshold and oxygen availability becomes limiting, then the nitrite that's accumulated in the plasma from the production of nitric oxide gas is especially reduced back to nitric oxide in a schema, in a hypoxic or low oxygen conditions. So what you do is you create this buffer. And really, the ability to produce nitric oxide predicts your exercise capacity or how well you can perform. So if you have good endothelial function, you start exercising, you build up this buffer of nitrite. And then when you reach that anaerobic threshold, that nitrite becomes nitric oxide. You extend the anaerobic threshold, you improve mitochondrial efficiency, and you get less lactic acid buildup, better recovery.
So as it is so important, and you're doing your work that will hopefully have a clinical application, or obviously already does, is there more research that other pharmaceutical companies are engaged in based on the platform that that you're aware of and you think might have promise? I mean, let's say, you know, the use of nitroglycerin, for example, as a vasodilator is something probably goes back who knows how long, 80 years at least. So the understanding of the ability to dilate blood vessels via this pathway, I think, has been, you know, well described for an awful long time. But where are we now in the research?
Well, you know, the problem with organic nitrates, which, as you mentioned, have been used over 100 years for the treatment of acute angina, have limitations. You know, patients develop tolerance to these drugs. Outcome data, long-term studies, or long-term use of organic nitrates lead to poor outcome. So this certainly isn't the solution. You know, in 2001, the nitric oxide field took a big hit. There was a company called Nicox out of France who was developing a COX-2 inhibitor with a nitroester bond on it, so it could produce nitric oxide and selectively inhibit COX-2. And at that time, you know, a lot of these COX-2 inhibitors were causing increase in heart attacks and strokes, and the black box warnings were put on Celebrex and Vioxx. And the whole approach was, can we modify these drugs? And we were doing a lot of the pharmacokinetics for many of these NO hybrid drugs. And NO naproxen, which was the first one to go before the FDA, was denied approval. And that really put the pharmaceutical company, really the pharmaceutical industry, in a tailspin, because everybody had a nitro ester or an NO modified drug. And then, you know, when we came out with our technology, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 years ago, where we deliver a solid dose form of nitric oxide, then that really changed the whole paradigm. And now we're taking the same technology. And I was the first person to develop a solid dose form of a bioactive gas. So to me, that solves the riddle. I'm not aware of any, well, in COVID, there were a couple of companies making a nebulized kind of a nasal spray for COVID to kill the coronavirus in early exposure. And I think it would probably be effective during acute symptoms or acute infection. But the problem with COVID is it's a systemic disease, right? Once it attaches to ACE receptors on every cell in the body and causes systemic disease. So that's not going to be effective. You need a systemic drug. So I'm not aware of anybody, any pharmaceutical company where we are in phase 3 clinical trials for our oral drug. You know, we've got a drug study going on for ischemic heart disease, ischemic non-obstructive coronary disease. As you know, we're about to enter into an Alzheimer's drug study. We've gotten very good preliminary results with that. And then our topical drug for diabetic ulcers and non-healing wounds. So I'm not aware of any company that's as far advanced as we are.
Wonderful.
In nitric oxide-based drug development.
Exciting. Are we able to talk about what's upcoming for you in the future in the literature department?
Sure. You know, for me, I've spent 20 years in basic science, published hundreds of peer-reviewed scientific papers. And as you're aware, most lay people don't read the scientific literature. And so what we try to do, and I think that's why it's so important what you do, is help communicate science to the masses. And what we've done now is, you know, I signed with a major publisher last year, but I've got a book called The Secret of Nitric Oxide coming out probably late fall, early winter. And really the point is it's twofold. So it's going to tell the story of, it's not autobiographical, but kind of it tells the story of the discoveries we made and how that changed the way we thought about nitric oxide and how this led to development of what I hope by the end of the year we have safe and effective drugs approved by the FDA and on the market. But number two, it's really to inform the reader on how important nitric oxide is and really discussing the topics we discussed today on, you know, what are you doing that you may not be aware of that's disrupting nitric oxide production? I mean, for when I give these lectures, when I talk about mouthwash, it's like the light goes off. I go, oh, well, I had no idea. And so my objective is to open the eyes of the masses and start people to realize that, hey, nitric oxide is important. And if you have a poorly managed disease with standard pharmacotherapy, then start taking into consideration some of these common sense approaches and restore nitric oxide and be able to wean off drugs, right. Allow the body to heal itself. And that's how humans are designed to react.
Who knew? What a concept, right? Just get out of the way and let good things happen. That's what it's all about.
The body heals itself. Give the body what it needs, the body heals itself.
So thank you for sharing your time with us today. This is incredibly valuable and enlightening information. And we're going to follow the development of this story very, very closely over the years to come. And certainly, I think you and I have a lot more to talk about moving forward. So again, thanks.
Absolutely.
That was quite a program, wasn't it? Nitric oxide, NO. We're going to be learning so much more about it, but how incredible it is that this chemical in our bodies does so much and yet is highly influenced by the functionality of the bacteria living in the mouth. It makes a lot of things a little bit clearer. The relationship between oral health, for example, and things like Alzheimer's, diabetes, and elevated blood pressure. What a fascinating interview that was. I urge you to learn more about nitric oxide. He has a new book coming out. Can't wait for that. But for now, I'm Dr. David Perlmutter, and I want to thank you for joining us today on The Empowering Neurologist. We'll be back soon. Bye for now.